So welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. This is John Williams, and Pete Zimmerman's the producer. Elise Glink normally starts us out on Mondays, and today is no different than any other Monday. She's the real estate and financial wellness expert and the owner of Think Glink Media. She's also the author of 100 Questions Every First-Time Home Buyer Should Ask. Hi, Elise. Welcome back.
Hi, John. Nice to be here.
How was the weekend real estate-wise, and how is it doing these days?
Well, it's interesting. A couple of things that popped up today. There's a new study by Rentop that took a look at the most expensive and least expensive communities in the U.S., and Chicago clocks in at 35th most expensive. So we're in the bottom half, and that's actually a good thing for us. But I was surprised to see that New York and Los Angeles have swapped number one and number two places, and places like Newark and Oakland are way at the top, top 10.
Are you talking about cost of living or cost of real estate?
It's the cost of buying a home in any of those communities. And that's something that's getting more and more expensive. In fact, the affordability index has become, and that's what the survey is called by Realty Hop's housing affordability index. And what they look at is your household income, the home prices, average home prices, what percentage of income is required for home ownership, and what the estimated mortgage and taxes are.
That's an interesting point. So it's not just the cost, but it's how much money do you make, because that's really the factor. How much money do you have, right?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, typically when you go to buy a house, your lender is going to look at what you're earning and how much of a loan you need compared to what you earn. So debt to income is DTI, is the ratio that they look at. Most lenders won't allow you to push beyond 36% of gross monthly income when it comes to figuring out if something's affordable. And if you're getting an FHA loan, which is why most first-time buyers get them, they're going to let you go all the way to 43%. Of your debt, of your gross monthly income, which after you get to the after-tax side, you're looking at more like 55 to 60% of take-home pay.
I'm surprised it's that high. I mean, I'm surprised they would allow you to borrow that much.
Well, you know, they've done a lot of research over the years, and that's really the upper limit of what people can afford. But they want to get more people to buy homes, and if you just leave it at 36%, a lot of people won't be able to get there.
I guess so, but even 36%, I guess I've not been paying attention. So of your gross income, a third to a half is going, and that's of your gross, not your take home, is going
correct.
Directly to your mortgage. Is that, I don't mean to drill down too deep here, but does that include the insurance and taxes?
That it does. So it's even worse, right? It's mortgage, taxes, and your insurance premiums. Oh. And typically insurance premiums aren't that big a bite, but your taxes can be depending on where you live.
Okay, so then number one is
New York.
New York. Number two?
L.A.
And Chicago is 35 on that list?
It is. Miami is number three.
I would think that Chicago would be much higher on that list.
And so what it really shows you is this is a function mostly of the lack of property price appreciation over the past 10, 12 years compared to many, many other communities that are seeing a tremendous increase. And so places like Boston or Jersey City, it may be that the household income's not as high, right? But home prices are really high. And so it's the ratio that this survey looks at to try and figure out where you can live. But there were a whole bunch of surprises on the list. There were also surprises on the downside. Cheapest places to live, Detroit is still, once again, the most affordable U.S. market, a little bit more expensive than it was in June, but the median asking prices of homes is now about $75,000, right? It's a lot less than here in Chicago.
Yeah, no kidding. That one doesn't surprise me. I'm sorry for Detroit. I think it would be nice if they started to climb up that ladder a little bit and show signs of recovery.
Yeah, well, they have been. I mean, their asking prices increased 4.2%, I think, over the last 6 months or so. But yes, Detroit has really suffered, and they've been suffering since about 2007.
I have a Shinola watch, which is not inexpensive. It was a gift 1 year, and those are made in Detroit. And if you haven't Googled that, their products are fantastic. Shinola, made in Detroit. Let's pick it up here in just a minute. Elise Glink's on the line. Elise, I also saw on this LendingTree report, 7 in 10 Americans report not being able to find products they need or enjoy, the services they've come to rely on because of product and labor shortages. Brenda and I were at an appliance store the other day. We were looking at a new gas range, and they go, yeah, you might be able to get one in 2 weeks, could be 6 months. We'll see what comes off the truck.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, and in the meantime, you can just use your grill and grill outside. We're seeing that all over the place, John. It's kind of interesting. My husband, Sam, had the same experience going to find a bicycle. Basically, the woman who owns the bike store looked at him and said, yeah, I'm 2,500 bikes behind. Check in with me next year. And the store was completely empty. We saw this happen, you know, right at the beginning of the pandemic when we really had a supply chain interruption, right? We stopped getting things from Asia that we were normally getting, or from Europe, yeah, or from Africa. And we had trouble even in the United States matching up where we had supply, like, say, Big Logs, and the actual mill where they were turned into things like paper towels and toilet paper. Last week, Home Depot was out of sprinklers. So a lot of this is going on, and 7 in 10 Americans are reporting that they can't find what they need.
Sprinklers. I mean, I know you want sprinklers in the summertime because of the drought and you want to mow your lawn. How sprinklers don't have chips? It's hard to anticipate what is and isn't available.
Yeah, it is, because it, of course, it isn't just about the chips, although, you know, we're seeing a car shortage because of chips. We're seeing, you're finding an oven range, believe it or not, appliances have chips in them.
I guess so.
Things that you would normally have, like water shutoff valves, are now being produced with chips. And so when you don't get chips, you're not getting all those things. But sprinklers, some do have chips, right? Things that actually turn on the sprinklers on and off automatically. But the actual sprinklers themselves, they're having trouble getting in enough stock for them, and a lot of them were being used, I guess, were shipped out to the West, where they were having an even worse drought than we are having right now. I said on the third or fourth in a rainy day in a row, not so much of a drought here anymore. But it is interesting. The other thing that people are finding is that not only can they not find what they need, but they're paying more for it, and that's probably because of shortages that are driving up the cost.
I suppose, too. Say a sofa, which doesn't have a chip in it, but if the factory that makes the sofa requires some sort of high-end technology, maybe that slows down things that we might not expect. The most commonly cited product shortages include meat, gas, appliances, cars, lumber. Yeah, meat and gas, too. And prices are going up, I guess, for those things as well.
Yeah, I mean, there are people are involved in this as well, right? It's not that we're producing everything by a mass factory run by artificial intelligence, although that is the way it's portrayed on television and in the movie theaters. But, you know, in the real world that we all live in, people are required to do this. And so one of the shortages that companies are seeing is the shortage of labor. And so they're trying to find people to come back and take up these jobs, but that's been a little bit of the big sort of labor mismatch that we're seeing across the country.
Hispanic homeowners are increasing. Is that right? More Hispanics are owning homes now?
Yeah, it's interesting and really good news, right? What we're seeing is that Hispanic homeowners, the number of Hispanic homeowners is rising, especially compared with Black homeowners, which has not risen quite as quickly. But over the last 6 years, we're seeing that home ownership for Hispanics has risen to about 50% of Hispanic or Latino homeowners owning their home, up from about 45% in 2014. And that's increasing faster than actually the rate for white or Black Americans, which is really nice news. Part of the reason that that's happening is that more than half of Hispanic homeowners live with family or friends in order to save up for it. And they're also getting help making those payments, financial help from other adult relatives that are living in their home. About 10 years ago, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which run the secondary mortgage market here in the country, they started pushing out a new way of sort of approving people who might have multifamily income. And so what they were trying to get at is this trend that we're seeing out there of different adults of different generations living together in a multi-generational household. And they wanted to find a better, neater way to account for all that income that was coming into the household to help more people afford to buy their own homes. And it looks like for the Hispanic community or Latino Americans that this has actually worked really well for them. And I think this is part of the reason that we're seeing the boosting of home ownership.
I guess any mortgage has a certain inherent risk for a lender. And so I'm just wondering how they would calculate that. If you have multiple incomes in a household, maybe that's attractive. But by the same token, maybe somebody's going to leave because they don't want to be in a multiple income household. They don't want to live with their mom or dad, or the mom and dad don't want to live with the kids or the uncles. And so they exit. Now, who's going to make the mortgage payment? I could see that working against the buyer as much as for.
Right. You could see that. But of course, if you have a married couple and they get divorced after they close on the house, you can have the same question. So really what we're trying to do, or what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac was trying to get lenders to understand, is that many communities are now building these multi-generational households. And in fact, you know, as many as I think it's 15 or 19% of American families of homeowners now have multiple generations living in it of adults. So parents and grandparents, for example. And this is working out really well. There's a big story about this same thing in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend. They looked at a number of different families up and down the income spectrum who were having, let's say, parents and grandparents. Grandparents have Social Security income. Maybe they've got some pension income. That just gets added to the amount that can be spent on the house. And they also usually come with some cash because they've had more years to save. And that helps people get over the affordability hump.
So what's the scenario then? Maybe dad's died, mom's alone. We put her in a granny cottage or give her a kitchen and her own bathroom in the basement or somewhere in the house, right? We're not going to stick her in the basement, but you get the idea. And then her
we know where your mother-in-law is going, John.
And then her income gets added to your income. Maybe that's an attractive arrangement, huh?
It is, and it's great for grandchildren. So we're also seeing that parents need some extra hands, particularly this last year with, you know, working from home, taking care of the house, kids at home going to school. Extra hands or deck are good. But it isn't just single grandparents. It's couples as well that want to live near their children, and they're finding that if you buy a larger house or a larger property, there are places for everybody to have their own space, and yet you get to come together to have this kind of really nice congregate multi-generational experience. And immigrant families tend to be more open to this than people who are born in the United States. It's just something that's very commonly done in a lot of Asian communities, African communities, and European communities.
I know the Hmong community, the Vietnamese communities, they are very comfortable living one in another.
It's expected.
Almost. And I think Native Americans don't necessarily feel that way. By that, I don't mean Indian Americans. I mean Native Americans, the people who have grown up here in this country. I don't sense that same willingness to live with your brothers and sisters.
Well, as the property continues to get more expensive, that may change as well.
Yeah,
we'll have
see. No kidding. Elise Glink. ThinkGlink.com. Always a pleasure. Thanks, Elise.
It's a pleasure, John. Talk to you soon.
This is WGN Radio. Pete Zimmerman produces this show, and Jim Dahlke joins us now. Jim's a frequent guest on the show. You can read his stuff at Chicago Inno, where he's the senior editor. Hi, Jim. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Let's catch up on how the player's trunk is helping college athletes cash in. What's going on here?
Yeah, the Player's Trunk is a really interesting startup in Chicago. Just a handful of employees, very small company, but has really gained a lot of traction and has got some notoriety early. So this is a business founded actually by a couple of former basketball managers at the University of Michigan who set out to kind of help ex-college athletes sell their game-worn gear online. So they're working with a couple of Michigan basketball players, help them sell, you know, game-worn jerseys and shoes, and have really kind of skyrocketed as a place for ex-college athletes to earn a little additional income by selling some of their game-used gear that sort of otherwise would have, you know, just collected dust or, you know, been more difficult to sell. And so an interesting thing for them is that their business is seeing actually a boost because of the NCAA's new NIL rules, which allow current athletes to get paid. And so now, along with selling ex-players gear, they're going to sell merchandise from current players. So Buddy Boeheim, the star basketball player for Syracuse, for example, has a specially designed sweatshirt and t-shirt on the platform. They've got a handful of athletes that are already on board. So really interesting to see the Players Trunk, a local company here, now with an opportunity to get some even more buzz in business.
Yeah, and they were in business before. I've talked to these guys, and they're nice kids. They're bright kids. I think they saw an opportunity, and I guess this court ruling then helps them, huh?
Absolutely. I mean, it opens up an entirely new vertical. And really what it allows them to do is to capitalize on sort of viral fame for these athletes as it's happening. I mean, the basketball players previously that were selling their stuff on Players Trunk, you know, had to do so after they graduated, after the March Madness tournament was over, after their sort of one shining moment was wrapped up. And now what they can do is kind of capitalize on a player's success in real time.
Yeah, that's right. Now that you mention it, I mean, because after you've graduated, what are they going to do? Kick me out of college? I'm out of college. I'll take the gym shoes I wore and you can have them, the helmet in the football game. I guess the kids got to keep some of that equipment legally, legitimately, maybe not a football helmet for a football player, but sneakers and jerseys, stuff like that, huh?
That's right. And so the current players won't be selling any of that because all that gear obviously still belongs to the university. So no shoes and jerseys and helmets for the current guys, but they can sell autographs. They can sell, you know, sort of custom designed hoodies and sweatshirts and different kinds of memorabilia that way, too. So the products are a little bit different, but I think the opportunity actually is a little bit bigger.
Speaking of, yeah, maybe they'll make more money this way. In fact, almost surely they will. Speaking of cashing in, catch us up on what Cameo is doing in Chicago.
Yeah, so actually Cameo, in a similar way to the Players Trunk, is seeing a boost with the NCAA rules as well. So, you know, they have opened up their platform to current college athletes who are already making money through them. So Spencer Rattler, quarterback, Oklahoma, he's already on the platform, a handful of others as well. So Cameo sees a big opportunity for the NIL space as well, and opens up a new vertical of famous faces on their platform. And you know, just this week, actually, we took a look at some of the competitors that are sort of coming after Cameo. There's a couple of things in the news recently. TikTok announced that it's testing a feature called Shoutouts, which lets users request and pay for video messages from TikTok creators. And it's a really early version of that right now, but kind of shows the possibility of TikTok sort of encroaching on Cameo space. And actually, even a company called American Greetings, which is the second largest card maker behind Hallmark, they have an e-card service called SmashUps, which lets you buy custom video shout-outs from celebrities like Alicia Keys and Dolly Parton. So really kind of running the gamut of companies that are encroaching on Cameo's territory.
Alicia Keys would do a personal, specific shout-out for somebody?
Well, here's the thing. So basically what American Greetings is offering is a bit more formulaic than what Cameo does. So it basically has a drop down of about 1,200 different names that basically, using their technology, they can sort of sneak your name into Alicia Keys' song. So she'll sing a song, she'll incorporate your name into it and the occasion. So if it's like for a birthday, for example. So Alicia is not doing the sort of personal touch that you get on Cameo with the celebrities, but it is a famous face that's going to, you know, say your name in a birthday e-card. So not quite a one-to-one comparison between the two, but still in the market for celebrity shout-outs.
One more today. Let's talk about flexible workspaces. What's happening there and who's capitalizing on that in Chicago?
Yeah, there's a company called DeskPass, launched several years ago. Essentially, they set out to be a class pass for co-working spaces, essentially allowing you, you know, with one DeskPass membership to work at multiple co-working spaces across the city or in multiple cities. So you were not necessarily tied to one type of co-working space. They have created a business-to-business product which allows companies to offer DeskPass as a benefit to their employees. So, you know, we think about how the coronavirus has impacted co-working, and maybe it's given a hit to the people who, you know, maybe the one-off entrepreneur who maybe would rather just work from home. Now, There's a big opportunity, I think, in co-working for businesses who want to allow their employees to work at co-working spaces, especially if they're looking to downsize some of their square footage or maybe eliminate the office mm-hmm. altogether. So DeskPass grown into 4 new cities just this year. Now they're in 26 markets. They opened in Sydney, Australia, their first international market this year. And they've booked more than 100,000 times across the platform. So a lot of interesting growth for a company that I think is really poised to grow at an interesting time.
Jim Dahlke, senior editor, Chicago Winnow, chicagowinnow.com. Okay, Jim, good job. Thanks for your help today.
Thanks, John.
Into the WGN Radio Newsroom now. More business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The Pepsi bottling plant in Munster is the target of a new strike today. Truck drivers and other delivery people have walked off the job after rejecting a new contract offer. They don't like what the company wants to make them pay for their health insurance. The company's production workers accepted a contract offer, so they'll be working today. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
We've got the business of food and Steve yep. Alexander.
Yeah, it's the time of year, Johnny, when moms and dads in the front seat hear this.
Are we there yet?
It is vacation time, and a lot of RVers and their motorhomes and camper trailers are hitting the road, which brings us to this fella.
His name is Joel Holland, and I'm the CEO of Harvest Hosts.
And Joel is going to tell us how farmers, wineries, and others in the business of food can add to their revenue stream simply by allowing RVers to park for the night.
We never charge them anything to be in the program. There are no long-term contracts or obligations. We just ask that they allow one or more of our members to stay overnight when they visit. And in return, our visitors spend on average $50 per night when they visit a host, buying the, you know, the produce and the wine, et cetera. And we don't take any cut of that.
Joel says Harvest Hosts has over 200,000 members looking for places to park their RVs, and hosts can earn an average of $13,000 a year, and they don't have to invest in electrical or sewer hookups.
We call this boondocking. And so our members, our RVers, they come fully self-contained. So the only requirements for a host location is that they have a, you know, relatively flat surface for our members to park in and a product to sell them so that our members can kind of fulfill that social contract in return for visiting.
There are already quite a few Harvest Hosts in the land of Lincoln.
In Illinois specifically, we have 58 hosts, a wide variety between farms and wineries and golf courses and interesting experiences.
And there are some unforgettable experiences.
My first experience in the program was visiting an alpaca farm in Kansas. It run by 3 nuns in their 80s. One of the nuns made alpaca scarves, one made soaps, and one gave massages. That's the example of Harvest Hosts. Every time you stay with one of our farms, you come away with a really cool experience and a great story.
You can find out more at
harvesthosts.com.
So pack up and get ready to hear this.
Are we there yet?
We get there when we get there.
Take it easy, Dad. At the Chicago Board of Trade, corn, beans, and wheat all trading higher today. Double digits. Corn is up 14 cents. Soybeans are up 20, and wheat is trading about 25 cents higher. Today's National Pecan Pie Day, or Pecan Pie, if you prefer. Also, a belated salute to yesterday's National Blueberry Muffin Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Remember in the summertime, we used to talk about box office receipts and everybody would go to the movies? Well, let's do that. Amy Guth, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Hey, John. How's it going today? Happy Monday.
Yeah, likewise. So Monday would be the day we'd say, okay, what was the big at the box office? Actually, that conversation's coming back, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That's a thing we can do again. And this was a really interesting bit of info from Disney. So they released the superhero adventure movie Black Widow, first Marvel movie in a couple of years, and it captured $80 million in the first weekend. I thought it was really interesting because they released it both on streaming and in the theater. So that was kind of interesting. So $60 million was in Disney Plus Premier Access. So you could pay extra in your, you know, in your streaming service to get access to it. It collected $78 million overall. And so overall, the global box office haul is $158 million. So we're breaking out that $60 million of it from streaming and the rest from US and foreign markets. That's a pretty big number. So there, you know, some Disney executives were talking about how, you know, we're looking at this in a different way now. We're kind of looking at both streaming and the traditional box office number. They didn't, however, release that same kind of data around Cruella or Raya and the Last Dragon. So those were also premiering simultaneously in theaters and on Disney Plus. So unclear if they're going to keep reporting this way or if they're just going to share their good news this way. But it is really interesting to see that big of a haul from streaming while theaters are open and also getting that big of a haul.
Are you assuming that Raya the Last Dragon and Cruella didn't do as well then? That's why they didn't give us those numbers?
Unclear. You know, I kind of felt like Cruella had a lot of press around it. It seemed like it did pretty well. So that's unclear why exactly. Maybe they're, you know, just kind of doubling down on this because it was Marvel and Marvel always does really well. Maybe they wanted to show that, hey, we can match both theater box office and home streaming and look how, you know, look at these substantial numbers. Unclear if you know, maybe they'll release those numbers down the line. But I think that was really interesting because I think there was so much speculation around what's going to happen when theaters are open and people are comfortable going to them, when people are vaccinated and all of that. And it looks like this other revenue stream has not slowed down. It's still quite open, the home streaming option.
Engagement rings are selling better than last year.
Yeah, I thought this was a really interesting story. CNN had put together some reporting around this. They talked to a bunch of people that are in the engagement ring industry, and turns out that they're seeing an uptick in rings. And part of that, the owner of The Clear Cut, which is a New York-based engagement ring company, they said they felt like the feedback they were getting from their customers is that now that people can travel again, they'll go do the proposal. So I guess no one wanted to just propose in the living room when under stay-home orders. People can travel and, you know, go do a big elaborate proposal, things like that. Of course, you and I have already talked about wedding venues. That's been a thing. Everybody that had their wedding postponed in 2020 is looking for that space in 2021 and beyond, competing with people who more recently got engaged. So I think the wedding industry will be fascinating to watch just in the next probably year, if not longer, as we see couples kind of scrapping over wedding venues, things like that. Some vendors said, including photographers and things like that, they were booked, you know, 2-3 times a day. They were very, very booked. Some venues are moving to open weekday weddings and things like that because their weekends were completely booked up. So a good time to be in the wedding business, but also the engagement ring business. Another part of that that I thought was interesting in this reporting is that the Rock is a little bit bigger than it was in years past because theoretically, if you weren't going out, if you did have disposable income during the pandemic and you were staying home, not going out to eat, things like that, not going out shopping, perhaps you were able to invest a little bit more into that engagement ring.
Do you know what the size is?
I don't know the size. That whole conversation is so lost on me, like carat sizes and what all that means. But unclear about that. But just the demand was a little bit up, and yeah. I thought that was pretty interesting to see how the wedding venue or the wedding industry has been impacted by this in such a positive way.
I would think that Virgin Galactic would be having a robust day today. It's not. What's going on here?
Yeah, so, you know, as I'm sure everybody saw yesterday, Richard Branson went up in one of his own, you know, spacecraft vehicles, and there was video of them reaching that, you know, suborbital area of getting into some zero gravity and kind of floating around. But then this morning, they filed to sell up to $500 million in common stock. And so we saw a little bit of a dip from their company, wiped out some value there. At one point, trading for Virgin Galactic was briefly halted just due to that kind of volatility back in motion there. But, interesting kind of 1-2 punch there. You know, so many eyes were on them, and it kind of upped the ante for Jeff Bezos, who's going to space later this month. Last week, I think I said on July 23rd, that's not accurate. He's actually going on the 20th. So we've got that right around the corner, and it felt like a bit of one-upmanship that, you know, Sir Richard Branson went up on Sunday. So it seemed like, you know, just very bright stars for Virgin Galactic, and then this little bit of a ding on Monday with that big stock sell-off announcement.
Yeah, Branson is sort of the Sputnik of the billionaire space race, isn't he?
That's right. I know. Billionaire space race. What a funny term even just to think about. But of course, you know, Elon Musk has had space ambitions for quite a while, too. Yeah. So it continues.
Nice to talk to you. Thanks for your help, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.